The story of Esther begins with Vashti, Queen Vashti. She is summoned to the king while he is throwing a party. He is drunk and wants to impress his guests. And so he summons Queen Vashti to come to this males-only party wearing her crown so that they can all see how beautiful she is. She refuses and is banished for her disobedience. But this leaves the king lonely, and so a search is begun for a new queen. This is a really crazy story. This is the part where it begins to look like a bad version of The Bachelor. Women of the empire are gathered up into a harem where they are plumped up and prepped for their one night, their one shot with the king. Esther is one of these women who is gathered up into the king's palace. She is Jewish, though that fact is concealed from others in the palace, on the advice of her uncle and guardian, Mordecai. After months of preparation, it is Esther's turn to spend the night with the king, and he is so impressed with her that he immediately crowns her as queen. Meanwhile, Mordecai has been staying close to the palace to make sure Esther is doing okay, and therefore he is able to hear a plot to kill the king. He passes this information on to Esther, who is able to alert the king, and the plot is foiled. Then we get introduced to the story's next villain, Haman. The king has just promoted Haman over all the other officials and commanded that all the servants who are around the king's gate, that all of them must bow down to Haman. Now, the king's gate just happens to be where Mordecai hangs out. And one day, Haman comes expecting everyone to bow down to him and all of his awesomeness. And most everyone does. But not Mordecai. Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman. This enrages Haman, but he decides that laying hands on Mordecai is, well, beneath him. And so instead, he hatches a plot to wipe out not just Mordecai, but to wipe out all the Jews. Haman goes to the king and offers to put lots and lots of money into the king's treasury if the king will only send out a decree ordering the destruction, annihilation, and killing of all Jews in Persia. The king and Haman agree on the terms, send out the decree, and sit down to a drink together. Meanwhile, the whole city is thrown into a state of confusion and fear.
When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on a sackcloth and ashes and went throughout the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting. And most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what was happening and why. Hatak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hatak went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a message for Mordecai, saying,
all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone, may that person live. And I, myself, I have not been called to come to the king for 30 days.
When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther.
Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another corner. But you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this.
Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai,
okay, go. Gather all the Jews to be found in Susa. Hold a fast on my behalf. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night and day. I and my maids, we will also fast as you do. After that, I will go. I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.
Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him.
This is a crazy story. This is a strange Bible story. Throughout the entire book of Esther, God is never mentioned. Not once. Not once in the entire story does God appear. Not once does any character speak God's name or even allude to it. Not once is God mentioned as having done anything. It's a strange story. And yet, God appears to be backstage, waiting in the wings, or rather, God is at work just behind the scenes throughout the story. The orphan girl, Esther, becomes queen. Mordecai happens to overhear an assassination plot, an event that will later save his own life. God is nowhere and everywhere in the book of Esther. As you heard, the story takes a while getting all the characters in place. The king gets drunk, demands his queen Vashti come and show off her beauty for the benefit of his gentlemen's gathering. She sensibly refuses. His drinking buddies come to him and say that this sets a bad precedent. You have to get rid of her, or else all our wives will stop listening to us, too. So the king banishes Vashti, and then he and his drinking buddies set up the Miss Persia contest to find the next queen, and Esther, an orphan Jew, is chosen. This is a crazy story. Meanwhile, our uncle Mordecai is sitting by the gate. He overhears the assassination plot, warns the king, saves the king's life. Then Haman becomes the grand vizier and makes this rule that everyone has to bow down when he comes by, but Mordecai refuses, so Haman decides to kill him. Well, killing him isn't good enough for the grand vizier, so Haman decides to kill him and all of his people, all of the Jews. So as we heard, Mordecai reaches out to Esther. He asks her to approach the king. And Esther is afraid. Of course she is in this crazy world. Approaching the king without permission holds a death sentence, unless the king holds out his scepter and grants pardon. Do not pretend that you will be safe just because you live in the palace, warns Mordecai. But know this, if you keep silent at such a time as this, deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. There's something in that for me. Mordecai never names God directly, but the implication is there. There's this reminder that God's work will not be thwarted. Esther is free to choose whether or not she will live into that calling. But if she doesn't, even if she doesn't, deliverance will rise from another quarter because it is God's plan. God is at work and God doesn't need us. God will raise up people to do God's work, whether we sign on or not. And yet there's this tension in it. If you keep silent, Mordecai says, deliverance for the Jews will come from another quarter, but you will perish. Somehow our own deliverance is wrapped up in the deliverance of others. God is at work bringing deliverance. We get to be a part of that work. And somehow it's only in working toward the liberation of others that we find ourselves set free. If we keep silent while our brothers and sisters suffer, they will be delivered, but we will not share in their deliverance. If you keep silent at such a time as this, deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. But who knows? Mordecai continues. Maybe you became queen for just such a time as this. There's this tension in this book where God is nowhere and everywhere. We discover that we are both unnecessary and at the very center of the work of God. There's something comforting in that, something freeing, especially in these days where the sense of helplessness feels so overwhelming. Gives us the courage to press on, the courage to act, recognizing that we have a very real role to play, while at the same time taking responsibility for the success of God's work in this world out of our hands. We have this poem framed on the wall of our office at home. It's a prayer by Ken Untner. Shared it with leadership team a while back. Starts like this. He says, "It helps now and then to step back and take a long view. The kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it's even beyond our vision. We accomplish in our whole lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete." Which is a way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals and objectives includes everything. So this is what we are about. We plant the seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces far beyond our capabilities. We cannot do everything. And there's a sense of liberation in realizing that. Because this enables us to do something and to do it well. It may be incomplete, but it's a beginning, a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter in and to do the rest. We may never see the end result, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders. Ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future not our own. Esther does take a stand. She comes up with a plan, the plan works, and the Jews are delivered. The people find a future. The story has me wondering, where has God placed us? Where are we being called, you and I? What is the work that we are being invited to be a part of, raised up for such a time as this? What does God have in store for you? Where has God placed you? Maybe it's at work or in your family. Maybe you've been raised up to be a neighbor to someone who needs one. Maybe God has placed you at the school or the college, in the community, at work, in the prisons, or on the farms. Maybe you've been placed in this church because a time is coming or has come when this church needs you. Keep your eyes open. Be ready. Wherever you are called, there is plenty of work to be done. When we see the news at night, it's so easy to despair. We see the utter brokenness of the world around us. We remember times that seemed simpler. But maybe this broken world is the reason we exist. Maybe we have been placed here and now, raised up for such a time as this. A friend of ours, Sean Flory Replegal, said, "The Church of the Brethren has never been more relevant." Dave Banaszak put it like this at district conference last year. He said, "The world is blanketed in a suffocating and toxic cloud of violence and hatred. Society is adrift in a sea of immorality and amorality. Are these obstacles? No, they are opportunities. Onward, Christian soldiers, like a hungry man going after Moby Dick with a dinner fork and a jar of tartar sauce." In our present culture of bloodshed, if there ever was a time when the world needs to hear about Jesus Christ's nonviolent message of love for enemies, so embraced by our brethren spiritual ancestors, that time is ripe and it is now. And we are among those God has called to carry that message into our world. In our present culture of mass materialism and consumerism, if ever there was a time when the world needs to hear Jesus' message of simple living and dependence upon God, again, so embraced by our brethren and spiritual ancestors, the time is ripe and it is now. And we are among those called by God to carry that message into our world. In our society where persons are dying from loneliness and isolation, divided from meaningful personal contact by barriers of technology and apathy and self-centeredness, if ever there was a time when the people of our world long to hear someone call them brother or sister and really mean it, the time is ripe and it is now. And we are among those called by God to carry that message into the world. If ever there was a time when people needed to hear the gospel message of hope in Jesus Christ, hope that overcomes and cannot be extinguished by this present darkness, the time is ripe and it is now. And we are among those God has called to carry that message of hope into the world.